right, so welcome everyone. So my name is Bert Lee. This is my wife Sandy, and we'll be presenting a talk on financial freedom, whether or not you go overseas. And I think the latter part to me is the more important part, is whether you decide to go and work as a missionary or you decide to stay home. These are, I think, you know, what I hope are practical principles that you will find it helpful in your life as a Christian. Okay? So, as a quick background, this is not like a David Ramsey, you know, type of talk, and I'm not going to give you like concrete advice on how to spend your money about this or that. It's not that type of talk, but I hope you will find it equally helpful. This talk really comes in the middle of what we do as a couple often, which is we have a lot of mentoring relationships. And then in my case, I had the privilege of mentoring people both academically, but also in their faith journey, and then some who want to become medical missionaries. So in that context, we actually go through a series of talks with our mentees, and those are the four M's that you see there. Okay. So it's mission, medicine, marriage, and money, the four M's. And so this is the fourth in that series where we talk about money. But I think that the topic of money only makes sense from our perspective if you understand the other three M's. So I'm going to just do a brief overview of the kind of stuff that we emphasize on the other aspects, and then we'll get to the financial principles after that. Okay, so we'll start with the other M's. So the first one is to start out with a very basic question, which is, what is Christianity all about? And actually, I was asked this question one summer when I volunteered with Campus Crusade, which I guess is now CRU. One summer, I had a chance to spend a summer vacation in Tokyo, Japan, where I was able to teach English as a second language to the Japanese students. But in that context, we were able to make friendships and also share our faith in Christ. And then at that time, one of the students asked me, like a dream question for a budding missionary, right? Which is, what is Christianity all about? Okay? And actually, that question is a simple one, but it's a question that has actually kind of haunted me for a while, because it's actually a deeper question than you might think, of course. And so, I want to share with you maybe a perspective that you might have, and then perspective that I think you should have. So the answer that I gave was that, well, there's God, and then there's me, and then basically sin has separated us from God, and then Jesus, of course, is that bridge between us, and so because of Jesus Christ, we have this relationship with God. Okay? So then, that was my answer now about 40 years ago. Okay? But now that I chance to think about it, for the past 40 years, I think the answer is a little different for me now. And it's because of this passage in Matthew 5, which says that you are the light of the world, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who's in heaven. So I'd like to take a look, and I think the answer might be obvious to many of you, but what is missing in my explanation of what is Christianity about?
Our part.
Our part in what?
Story.
It's your story. Okay, good. What else?
Good works.
What's that?
Good works.
Good works, okay. What else?
The rest of the world.
Rest of the world, exactly. Yeah. There's a huge chunk that's missing in my brief explanation. And that's exactly right. Is that there is indeed me and the Father, okay, that is part of the story. But that's only a small part of the story, and the bigger part of the story is the world, okay? The Greek word is anthropos, is mankind, right? It's not man or woman, but it's mankind. But that whole thing is missing. And so as I contemplate on this, I realized I didn't really understand what Christianity was really about until I had a chance to contemplate on this a little deeper. So in other words, it's not just between me and God, it's actually between me and the world as well. And then it says here that they are to see your good works, and then they're supposed to glorify the Father. So there's actually a relationship between the world and the Father as well. So why is this important? Well, the reason why I think this is important is because this is what I would consider as being trigonometry. Okay? So I realize you didn't come here for a geometry lesson, okay? But this is actually just biblical trigonometry. Okay? So let me convince you of this. Okay, what's the great commandment? What is the greatest commandment? Well, that's not the great commandment. It's love your God, right? And then there's a second commandment, which is what? Love your neighbor. And then what's the Great Commission? Okay, so that trigonometry actually encapsulates all of those things, right? Because the Great Commandment says you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And this is the great and foremost commandment. Okay? So there is the first Great Commandment. But then, right after, Jesus says, the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, which is the base of that triangle. And then comes these two commands that depend the whole law and the prophets. I mean, these really summarizes everything that Jesus is trying to say. And then comes the Great Commission. As you know, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you. In other words, that is the hypotenuse of that triangle. Remember that? Okay. So now, if you notice something, okay, let's go back to geometry a little more. What kind of triangle is that?
Right triangle.
That's a right triangle, right? And remember, it's a right triangle, okay, that symbolizes the right relationship that we need to have with God, right? And the right relationship we need to have with the world, okay? And then you all know that there's a Pythagorean theorem. I told you this is geometry, right? This is a Pythagorean theorem that those three distances are related, right? And they're related, meaning that as I draw closer to God, and as I draw closer to others, what happens? That distance between others and God also gets closer. Okay? Okay? So this is not Pythagoras, this is actually Jesus Christ. Okay? Alright, if you're not convinced, here is 1 Peter 2:12. It says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentile, so that the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Okay? It's identical. It talks about the Gentiles, it talks about you, it talks about God. Okay? Same triangular relationship. Okay? Now, I think somebody already pointed out, but what is it that they're supposed to see? It's good deeds, and actually I'm struck by the fact that it's not good words, okay? It's actually good deeds. Okay? Good works and good deeds. And so I think for a Christian healthcare professional, okay, this is where the next M comes in, which is that as a Christian healthcare professional, you have to be a good doctor or a good nurse or a good physical therapist. Part of our good deeds is to be as excellent as we can be. And I didn't say perfect, because perfection is obviously not possible, but excellence is what we should be pursuing after. Now, I say that because in some contexts, being a Christian actually is kind of a second-class status when it comes to your quality. Okay, some people kind of excuse it because I'm saying I'm too busy going to Bible study, and then you neglect your work or you neglect your studies. And you don't keep up in your medical training. Okay? So the mission is really that trigonometry that I talked about. The part of that trigonometry is medicine, and that is the good works that I think that God is asking us to pursue. So every July, I literally have my students or residents or fellows, and I have them raise their hand, and I ask them one very sincere question, which is, I ask them to raise your hand if you want to be incompetent. Okay? And then, good news is nobody raises their hand. Okay? So nobody wants to be incompetent. Then I show him study like this. Okay? There's a whole bunch of them. I'm skipping a sample here. But one of the studies I show them is the one by McClinn. And this is a real study in the New England Journal of Medicine where they took 6,712 real patients from the state of North Carolina. So these are real patients, real doctors, real encounters. And they do the chart review and they say, okay, I see that this patient had hypertension. or this patient had diabetes, or this patient had a heart attack. And we know that the current evidence says we should do the following thing. Okay? How often are doctors actually doing them? Okay? So the most common example here is real patients who have a heart attack, they're simply asking, how many of them who are eligible to get aspirin, do they actually get aspirin? Okay? This is not new information. This is not groundbreaking stuff. This is not something fancy that only people in certain universities can do. This is basic healthcare that everybody's known about for decades. And they're asking, how well did these doctors do in the state of North Carolina? Okay? The answer was, it was about 50%. Okay? Not fancy stuff, but actually there's plenty of room for improvement in healthcare in the U.S. Okay? 55% of them follow evidence-based recommendations. Okay? Next one comes from my own field. I'm an ICU specialist, and this is a study by Colombo looking at 10 ICU attending physicians who are faculty members at a university hospital, and they're asked to look at ventilators and see if they can troubleshoot what's going on. And these aren't like trivial issues. These are issues that would actually cause significant suffering on the patient or potentially lead to death. And you ask them, how well can they identify these serious problems? Okay. About 44% of the time. Okay. And then these are ICU doctors. These are physicians who are making diagnosis of hyponatremia, which can be a serious problem. Again, okay, the diagnosis was correct 43% of the time. Okay. There are study after study after study that says, at least in the U.S., there's opportunities for us to do better as physicians. Okay. There's lots of room for improvement. And now these are individual field, individual subject matter, but more globally, this is a pretty landmark study in JAMA that's comparing U.S. healthcare compared to other well-developed countries in the world. And they want to know where U.S. ranks in certain areas. The first one that they looked at is in terms of healthcare spending. You can see that yellow on the very left, that's the U.S. And so we are the number one in terms of healthcare spending. The next country is roughly half the spending. Then comes the more important things like mortality. So here's overall lifespan. Okay, U.S. is dead last in, you know, among the well-developed nations, and it's true for maternal death rates or survival, and also infant mortality. Okay. U.S. ranks the worst among the more developed countries that they're comparing to, but we outspend them by at least 2 to 1. Okay? So all of this is to say is there is a lot to celebrate in U.S. healthcare. We have a great system in many ways, but at the same time, we have a tremendous amount of room for improvement. And I think personally, in medicine, this is where healthcare professionals who are Christians can make a real difference. This is where, by your excellence, okay, and by your devotion to patient care, you can make a dramatic difference in the outcome in this country and be the person who is able to show good deeds and good works. Okay? All right. So my encouragement to my trainees always is to pursue excellence. Okay? And then comes now marriage, before we get to money. Okay? So we talked about mission as being this triangular relationship. We talked about medicine, where we need to pursue excellence, and then comes marriage. So I asked another stupid question in July, and this question is a very difficult one, which is, what is 1 + 1? Okay, and of course they look at me like, you know, like I'm crazy. Okay, and then I give them an option. Okay, 1, 2, or 4, or some number like that. And they're all laughing at me at this point, of course. But then I change the question, and I say, okay, what if I change that question to not what is 1 + 1, but if two people are studying 1 hour each together, how many hours of studying will actually occur? Okay? Now that's a different question. Okay? You're studying 1 hour, you're studying 1 hour, how many hours of studying will occur?
1 hour.
Right? So in total, okay, you're lucky if you get each 1 hour of studying, right? Because what might happen is that you might interfere with each other, you might laugh, you might tell jokes, you might goof around, and you might influence each other in a negative way, right? And you might only get maybe 30 minutes of studying done instead of, you know, 1 hour each. However, It's also possible that maybe one of you knows something that's very helpful to the other person, and vice versa. And if you actually collaborate, you can help each other out, and it might be worth, you know, maybe 3 hours of study if you had done that alone, right? So 1 + 1 doesn't become quite so obvious when we talk about group situations, okay? So believe it or not, actually, that's a different question when you ask how many hours of study will occur. Well, it turns out that the answer could be one, and actually the Greeks have, you know, have already thought through these examples, and they call this the adynamic paradigm, where when you have 1 + 1, you interfere with each other. It's an internecine kind of situation where you actually harm each other, so you only get 1 + 1 = 1. Right? And then they call the next one the last one was anti-dynamic, and this was called adynamic. This is a neutral paradigm where indeed 1 + 1 = 2, which is what you would hope for. But they actually then said we should be striving for the pro-dynamic paradigm, where 1 + 1 becomes synergistic, and you can produce 3 or 4 or 5. Okay? So the reason why I ask this question is because much of healthcare is actually teams, is groups. Okay? You know what else is teams? It's actually marriage. Okay? And so that's why we talk about 1 + 1. And if you are really honest with yourself, okay, many marriages, 1 + 1, some cases, is -2. You're lucky if it's 1. Right? You're super blessed if it's 2, 1 + 1. Right? But when it comes to missions or life in general as a Christian, actually, what you want to aim for is a spouse where 1 + 1 becomes 4. Okay? And if you're single out there, that's what you should be asking that person. Ask them what's 1 + 1. Okay? So, believe it or not, there's a study about this. Okay? This is a study by a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, Anna Woolley, and she wrote this paper in Science, where she's asking this question, okay? And she talks about what's called basically your general intelligence, okay, which is what IQ tests are based upon. So, of course, we all have our own individual intelligence, but she proposes this idea of collective intelligence. This is where, in groups, how do people behave? So she calls this idea collective intelligence as opposed to the IQ. What you're seeing there is you're seeing groups of people working on a project together. And as they work on a project together, the bar in gray is the average performance in this group task. Okay? The blue is the most intelligent person in that group. So obviously, the most intelligent person does better than the average person. Okay? But what they found is that some groups have this effect. That's the collectively as a group, you outperform the smartest individual. Okay? And this actually, if you don't know, this is actually a paradigm for many businesses that they're trying to capture to increase productivity. Okay? And this actually is a formal field in academics where there's an MIT Center for Collective Intelligence, for example, trying to study this and to harness this. Okay? But I think in marriage, a Christian marriage needs to have this paradigm of you need to find a partner, or your partner needs to be that the kind of partner where you can have synergy. So I would encourage you to think about what's 1 + 1. Okay? So when you're lifting a heavy object and 1 + 1 = 2, that's perfect. Okay? But for most endeavors, research, education, healthcare, and medical missions and marriage, this is where you really want that pro-dynamic or synergistic paradigm. Okay? And what that means is you want complementary skills and diversity of skills. Okay? You want the same vision for missions. Okay? You want the same vision, but you want complementary skills. So if you then go back to the idea of mission that we first talked about, let's say you subscribe to the triangular view of Christianity, okay? And then you want to marry somebody or have a partner that shares that same worldview, right? So then, let's say the one on the left is you and the other one is your spouse, and you're getting married. Think about what the results could be, okay? If that is you, and you marry is exactly the same as you, that's what that would look like. Right?
And this is what a super a superfluous situation is, where 1 + 1 just becomes 1. You didn't add anything if your spouse is like that. Right? Now think about this situation where that's you, and now your spouse is like that. Okay? Well, this is a supplementary situation where indeed 1 + 1 becomes 2. But what you really want to aim for is this. If that's you, you want somebody who's going to complement your skills. Okay? What's the difference, you say? Well, this is the complementary, where 1 + 1 could be 4 or 10, or where that synergy exists. And the reason is, think about what happens when adversity comes. Because life is full of adversity. Missions is full of adversity. Ministry is full of adversity. And so when that adversity comes, the first two, you're not going to be able to withstand it. Okay? And so what you want is somebody who's your spouse, who shares that vision and love for God, but also a love for the world, who wants to bring God glory through excellent work. And now, you want the same thing for money. This is where money, your view of money has to be exactly the same for both of you. Okay? Your personality is going to be different, your skills are going to be different, but money, I think, is something that needs to be the same. Okay? So this talk is on achieving financial freedom, and the emphasis is whether or not you go overseas. Okay? So let's get started with the money aspect. Okay. So money is very important for lots of reasons. Here's just some sample. Here's a survey in 2010 that says that something like 60% worry, 60% of people worry about money all the time or more often than not. Okay? A lot of people worry about money. That may be true of you already in this room, right? Another study says that medical students owe about $250,000. Do we have medical students here, by the way, or we have a few? Okay. Does that ring about right, or you don't want to say? Okay. Okay. All right. So a lot of debt, yeah? And then couples, a more recent study, says that 69% had a major argument in the past year because about money. Okay, so it's a serious problem. I think you guys all know that. And then this is a term that I didn't come across until I was looking up some of the research stuff for this talk. They talk about financial infidelity. Anybody know what they're talking about here? This is not marital infidelity in the traditional sense. This is financial, which means that you keep secrets about where you're spending money. You have separate financial accounts. You're not honest with your wife about what you're spending money on, or vice versa. Okay? So a lot of problems here. Okay? And then, of course, as I'm sure you've heard, Jesus supposedly talked more about money or possessions than heaven and hell or any other topic. So this was obviously important to Jesus. Okay? So bottom line is, money is important. It's important to God. It's important to our faith. Okay? And then here's a quote from Charles Ryrie. That's from the Ryrie Bible, if you're familiar with that. But he said that how we use our money proves our love for God more conclusively than the depth of knowledge, length of prayer, or prominence of service. Because these things can be feigned, but the use of our possessions tells us who we actually are. I think it's a pretty sobering quote, in my opinion. Okay? So, one sub-point is that money is one of the best indicators of our faith. So, very important. Okay. So, back to some studies. Okay? The other thing that's important about money is illustrated here. I don't know if you're familiar with the study, but this is a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, or PNAS. And this is a study that they went to the state of California. Because the law is that if you have a person standing at a crosswalk like that, okay, the car is supposed to stop. Okay, it's a pretty reasonable law. That's probably true in many other states. What they did was they hired an actor to stand just like that, and the actor's job was to make eye contact with the driver. Okay, trying to get him to acknowledge that you're standing there. Okay, then they charted how often the car stopped or not. Okay. And the average percent that did not stop was 35%. Okay? Some of you look kind of guilty, by the way. But, yeah, okay. But that was a simple study. But then what they did was they had somebody else catalog the kind of car that was driving. and they cataloged it according to how much the car cost. What do you think they found? That's exactly what they found. Okay? That the more expensive the category of the car, more likely they're going to not stop. Okay? Fascinating, isn't it? Here's another study. Here's a study in Nature, and as many of you know, it's one of the most prestigious journals in science. And this is a study that's very interesting. They asked people to flip on their own a coin 10 times. Okay? You just have to count how many are heads, how many are tails. And I think you all know that the average number is supposed to be 5 heads and 5 tails, but it's going to vary from any one individual. Okay? And they asked them, how many of you had 8, 9, or 10 heads? Okay, so it should be an unusual event. Okay, but if you claim that you had 8 heads, 9 heads, or 10 heads, you get $20. Okay? Now, you did it on your own, so there's no way for me or anybody else to say that's the truth or not. Okay? But this is the opportunity for you to either tell the truth or maybe fib and get $20. So, for those of you who are math wizards, okay, it's a matter of doing some calculations, but it comes out to 5.4% is a true statistical probability of getting 8, 9, or 10 heads. Okay? So what do they do? Is they ask them to do this, but before they ask them to do this, they ask them two questions. Half of them were asked, okay, what kind of TV program did you watch last week? Okay? Kind of a neutral question. So you thought, well, maybe I saw this, I saw that. That's it. And then you flipped a coin and you answered whether or not you got 8, 9, or 10. Okay? The other half was, what do you do? And these were all employees at a bank. Okay? Who work with money. Okay? What do you think would happen? Well, if you were asked simply that how many hours of TV do you watch, the only 5% of people claim to have gotten 8, 9, or 10. Which means, statistically, that's what you should have gotten about. So they were probably telling the truth. Okay? But when you ask them, what do you do? And they realize, oh, I work for a bank. Okay? It went up to 19%. Meaning probably most of those people were lying. Okay? It's really fascinating. And so I think what these two studies tell us is that actually money is important, not only because Jesus said it was important, okay? Not only because it's a good indicator of our faith, but because money changes people. Okay? Money is important because it changes people. Okay? So money is important because it is one of the best indicators of our faith and because money changes people. And so, therefore, the obvious conclusion is that we have to be careful with money, and the financial stewardship has to be a spiritual priority. Okay? Now, Sandy's going to come up and share a little bit about this.
Hi, everyone. So, we just wanted to also share some practical ways that we approach money. And so, as Burton kind of shared, I think one of the things that happens to us as we walk in our faith is that on a daily basis, there's so many voices telling us what to do with our money. We can get it from the news, we can get it from podcasts, media, neighbors, friends, family especially, and even the culture that we're from, as well as even the church. And so with all these voices, I think one of the things that Burton and I said to ourselves is, sometimes God's voice, who a lot of times comes in a still, small voice, can get lost in the shuffle of it all. And then one of the conversations Burton and I had after a GMHC was, everybody wants to serve God. Everybody wants to do something with the Lord and be purposeful. So we have good intentions, but sometimes we kind of get lost in the day-to-day listening to all the voices. And so how do we stay focused? So one of the small things that we've done that has been a eureka for us, we got married in 1988. And so the first year we got married, suddenly we had this eureka moment of, we don't need to wait for a GMHC. We don't need to wait for Urbana. Why don't we just create our own personal family retreat where we go away and we spend time personally by ourselves and listen to God intentionally. It's kind of interesting that even though we're a married couple and we spend all the time together, especially now post-COVID, I see Burton almost 24/7 because he works from home. And so we would think then that we would have a lot of intentional conversations, but just being human, we spend a lot of our day-to-day talking about food, shows, etc., not a lot of intentionality. So we know then that we need to kind of purposely set aside time, and we call it like the tithing of our time. And we started it in 1988, and what we did is we talked about we want to be unlike the Church of Ephesus, where in Revelations the accusation is you forgot your first love. And we didn't want to be in that situation. So Burton and I said, how can we on a regular basis be reminded of our first love? When we got together, we said we really want to serve overseas. How do we keep that vision alive? And so what we did was said, let's create our own retreat with our own retreat schedule. And then also, let's pick retreat sermons, back in those days, cassette tapes, of people that we really felt moved our hearts. And so in 1988, we had just come from Urbana 1987. So the first retreat we went on, we went to Santa Barbara, and we took our cassette tapes that we had bought from Urbana 1987, and one of them was George Verver and Helen Roosevelt and also Tony Campolo, and we spent time re-listening to those sermons that had made us tearful and moved us. And then we said to ourselves with a discussion, why did that move us? What is still true for our lives? And how is God speaking to us today? Just to let you know, these retreats we've done every year since. We've taken our kids with us as well. And those old cassette tapes got transferred into more digital. And to this day, we're still sometimes listening to the same sermons that we've heard since 1987. We've added a few more because what we've done is we've added a library. Like anytime we feel like this sermon was really touching us, God has spoken to us, we put it into our family retreat file, and we just kind of go through all the sermons and then pick and choose every time, some different, some the same, and we listen to it to remind ourselves of our priorities. And then why am I telling you about this family retreat? The reason why is one of the first things that we did after we started this family retreat is we felt like budgeting and creating like a financial plan was part of our worship, part of our way of exercising our faith, and we're going to dedicate our yearly budget to the Lord. And of course, the number one priority would be the tithing and the charitable donations and also lifestyle choices. And so we first listen to the sermons to soften our hearts and get us in the right perspective. Then after that, we come up with a budget, and then we dedicate it to the Lord, and then we do this, and afterwards, we keep each other accountable by simply putting it on an Excel spreadsheet or Quicken, and we end the year evaluating, did we meet our goals? And we kind of have this strong accountability because numbers don't lie. And one thing for sure we don't want to do is say that we had promised God through prayer and dedication at our family retreat, this is what we're going to do financially. We don't want to then show God like we didn't obey. So this has been an internal financial obligation that has really helped us tremendously.
So there were moments when we wanted to buy a little nicer car, or we wanted to remodel our kitchen, because like everybody else, we like those kind of things. But sometimes listening to a sermon, you know, it really made us point our hearts in a different direction, and we had to, you know, adjust what we're going to do. So there were some times when we felt like it was a sacrifice. But I'd say for most of it, though, it is really a joy knowing that you could be obedient and you could see for yourself that you are following through on what you want to actually do. So the second principle besides money is important is obviously that we're supposed to seek His kingdom first. So this is a familiar passage to you in Matthew. It says, "Do not worry then, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things, but seek ye first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." And you can see the direction of the arrows. We're supposed to seek God first, and it's God who adds money. Okay, I think it's a passage that we all know, I think. And so one caution here is beware of the false dichotomy. And so in my experience of people that we met over the years who have a real sincere desire to serve God in ministry, you know, become a missionary or something like that, is that oftentimes we fall into this false dichotomy. What do I mean by false dichotomy? So the priority is pretty clear. The priority is that we're supposed to seek His kingdom first, and then He will add it to you. But oftentimes how we view it is as follows, okay? You ask yourself, should I become a missionary or somebody like that? And if the answer is yes, of course, we're going to live sacrificially. You know, we're not going to spend too much on this or that because we're going to be a missionary. Okay, so that's great. But then, if you decide you're not going to be a missionary, somehow you're released from that. Okay, somehow you decide, I'm going to go after money. Okay, I'm going to still be a Christian, but now I'm going to spend and live like everybody else in America. Okay? That, I believe, is what rich young rulers struggle with. Right? And so, you know, hopefully this is an obvious point, but I don't know if you realize this, but that's not the choice that you have. That's not the option that God gave you. Okay? The option is for us to be faithful to God no matter where you are, no matter what you do. So don't fall into the trap of this dichotomy. If you say, I don't want to be a missionary because I don't want to be poor, that's great. But if you don't become a missionary, the other option is not for you to be a rich young ruler either. Okay? It's the same thing that we're asked to do, which is to seek first His kingdom. Okay? So whether it's yes or no, it's the same principle. Okay? Which is why we want to emphasize this is whether or not you go overseas. The second point that comes from here, which is kind of obvious, is that therefore, since He is our first priority, we should give first to God. And this is a very pragmatic statement, but it's something that I think people fall into all the time. And so if you look at this study by George Bona, which is a Christian group, they studied 2,000 U.S. adults, and they asked about tithing in the year 2020. And so this probably doesn't shock you, but only 5% of U.S. adults say that they tithe. If you say you're a Christian, it's still only 21%. And even if you say you're a practicing Christian, it's 42%. So I'm not sure what practicing Christian means, but it's only 42%. Okay? So if you take a step and you think about this, is this because we as Christians are ignorant? I mean, probably not. I think these are principles that we all know about. Is it a matter of willful disobedience? Perhaps for some. But I think for a vast majority of people, we want to be faithful in tithing. We want to be faithful in giving. But it's a matter of priority. So what do I mean by priority? Okay. Well, what God is asking us to do is to take our income and give. So let's say tithe or something like that. Okay. And then you can make your decisions about buying a house, buying cars, etc. Okay. But I think what many of us do, if you don't have a financial plan, if you don't really think about this very purposefully, you buy your house first, you buy your cars next, you plan your vacations, and then you decide how much is in my pocketbook, and then you give to God. I mean, it's obviously simple, but if you do it the other way around, chances are you're never going to truly give. Okay? So it's simple as give first to God. Okay? All right, the third and final point is that you will likely have enough. Okay? And I'm saying likely, of course, because I don't know your individual situations. I know there's a lot of a lot of varieties out there, but I'm talking primarily in the case of, let's say, physicians or anybody in a similar category. Okay. So here is a very important study, and it's a study again in one of the journals for Nature in 2018, and this study actually looked at a very proverbial question, which is, does money buy happiness? Okay? It's a pretty important question, I think. Okay? And so this is the largest study on this topic. 1.7 million people were involved in this study. And they simply asked them, how are you doing in life? Are you satisfied? Are you happy? They asked different ways about happiness and contentment, life satisfaction, that kind of stuff. And they correlated with their income. Okay. What do you think they found? Does money buy happiness? No? I'm hearing no. Anybody say yes? Okay. Well, it turns out, actually, money does buy happiness. Okay. So, in fact, the more money you make, in general, the more happy you were. And also, not just in terms of emotional transient happiness, but in terms of life satisfaction. Okay, so there is a correlation with your income. However, okay, that association stopped at a certain point. Okay, and that's really important. So this is what the study found. Those different lines are different regions in the world. Okay, it includes Africa, Latin America, Asia, North America, and elsewhere. And if you notice, there is increasing happiness as your income goes up in every continent. But then what happens is it seems to plateau, and then it begins to actually decline. Okay? So this is called income satiety. Okay? So money does buy happiness to a certain degree, and it kind of makes sense, right? If you're really poor, you're going to be struggling quite a bit. So that part makes sense. Okay? But what it says is that after a certain point, okay, even though you could buy more stuff, that stuff is not going to buy you happiness. It doesn't bring happiness. And I think that's the part that we can all relate to, right? So in case you're wondering, what is that income? Well, it varies from every country to country. Okay, obviously, some parts of the world, it's a lot less. But for the U.S., it's $105,000. Okay? $105,000. So what I practically told a young couple recently is work hard till about $105,000. Okay. After that, you're only going to be less happy. Now, in contrast, these are relatively recent data for physicians. Okay. So obviously, some physicians make more, some make less. But even the poorest paid physicians are at least double, okay, that income satiety level. So that's the good news, is that if you're a physician, okay, you are well above this amount. And don't miss the point that if you actually make more, you might be more blessed if you actually give money away. Right? Yeah, if you actually have less money, you might be happier. That's what this income satiety is saying. Okay? So that's a great privileged position to be in if you're a physician or other healthcare providers with high income relatively. Okay? So the practical point here is that whether you choose to take advantage of things like MedSend or other scholarships, which are wonderful things for you to know about if you have medical school debt, what I'll tell you even more practically is if you are a physician, you already have enough money to pay off your school debts. Okay? You already have enough money to be perfectly fulfilled to the maximum potential. Okay? And you can also practically give to God without sacrificing your happiness. Okay? It's an incredibly important privilege that we have as healthcare providers. Okay? But don't listen to the other voices who says that your car needs to be fancier, your house needs to be this way or that way. Okay? But you actually practically have already enough money. Okay? So Sandy will come up and share the second story.
All right. I'm just giving you our own personal things. So Burton had mentioned that some of you all are going to graduate with either college debt or medical school debt and all that. And even if you might not be in that wonderful group of physicians that get the big salaries, that anyone that's in the healthcare profession, you have ability to have a steady income. When Burton finished, we had basically decided to join Southwestern Medical Clinic, which is a small Christian mission-minded hospital private practice in St. Joseph, Michigan. It was founded by our Christian hero, Dr. Bob Schindler. So when he signed this in 1998, just to let you know, his starting salary was $70,000 in 1998. So Burton said, with inflation, this would be about $132,000 today. We graduated with, thankfully, no college debt, but he did have a medical school debt, which was about $88,000, which is, in today's terms, about $178,000. So we had a little bit less than the average of $250,000, but thinking about $178,000 is still a pretty daunting task. So one of the things that I just want to encourage you about is that we kind of think like the number one other reason why we cannot serve God is we have this huge debt. It's kind of like having an extra mortgage. For us, we decided that we don't know anything else besides a student lifestyle. So until this debt is paid, we're going to still live like students. We're not going to live like the doctor. And so when we started to have to pay off the loan, you're going to get voices where people will say to you, especially banks, keep the loan as long as possible. It's low interest. You could pay the minimum monthly payment. And to this day, we still have siblings who are still paying off their college debt, and they're in their 50s. And they always say they can't do things because they have debt. For us, we decided we're going to do something very radical where we're going to be very aggressive about paying off the debt. And so we tried to pay off chunks on a regular basis with the goal that we will be debt-free as soon as possible. And so the reason why we're giving you the real numbers is, yes, a $70,000/$132,000 salary is a pretty decent salary, but it also can be sometimes for people like, oh, can we pay off debt at that rate? It's possible. So we basically ended up being debt-free with a zero balance after 3 years. And the reason why was because we still live like students, and we had this dedication idea that we want to be debt-free in order to be more free to serve the Lord. And so we're trying to encourage people to say, hey, you could make a radical lifestyle choice to help you get to where you want to go in terms of spiritual goals. And so it's possible. It's just why we want to share.
Okay, I think we're almost wrapping up. So the last point here is I want to point you toward the study. This is a study that actually has gotten some press in recent years, so you may be familiar with it. But if you're not, I think it's a fascinating study to consider. This is a study that was published in 1995. And what this study is about is they're asking whether or not it's better to be a silver medalist or a bronze medalist. Okay? Sounds like a silly question, right? But these are all Olympic athletes, okay, who actually won real medals in the Olympics. And they wanted to know, are silver medalists happier or are bronze medalists happier? So just logically, you would think, well, silver is higher than bronze, and they obviously did better, so they must be happier. But actually what they found is the opposite, okay? It was true on the medal stand as well as like right when the event finished, that actually bronze medalists were happier, okay? So why would that be? Well, it has to do with this idea of what's called counterfactual thinking. What that means is, I know I got silver, but then you begin to imagine what could have been true, right? And then I know I got bronze, but what could have been true? So in the silver medalist case, you are comparing your current situation where you got silver, and you're looking upward. It's called upper counterfactual thinking. And all that means is, if I had done this, I could have gotten gold. Okay? If I had done this, if I slept a little more, if I didn't eat that bad food, or if I trained a little harder, if I listened to my coach, I could have gotten gold. And you were actually less happy because you were so close to the goal. But the bronze medalists typically have what's called downward counterfactual thinking, which is you look down and you say, at least I didn't finish fourth. Right? Right? And so it's a matter of perspective, but actually that's the reason why bronze medalists looked happier in this event. So the reason I bring this up is actually that's also been studied, and it's called the country club effect. Okay? So let's say you're a physician and you have a comfortable income and you say, I love to play golf, and you know what? I want to join a country club because I deserve it. Okay? I like golf. I want to bring my friends to play golf. I can entertain my friends and family and guests. It'll be great. Okay? But what happens then is when you join the country club, guess what? There are other people who actually make more money than you at the country club now, and they realize, oh, their kids go to a fancier private school. Right? Then you realize, oh, I drive this very nice car, but then you realize this person drives even a fancier car, and you feel bad. You actually feel poor. Okay? There are actual reports of people who earn like $20 million on Wall Street who are unhappy and they feel poor because their neighbors in the country club earn $50 million, right? And this is what the country club effect is. Okay? Same thing about bronze versus silver medalists. Okay? Now, the modern equivalent of country club effect, I think, is actually the social media. Okay? And this is a very important thing for you to consider. Okay, this is a study that came out recently looking at when Facebook got introduced. Okay, this is when Facebook got introduced. It happened in college campuses, but it happened in certain college campuses in some planned fashion. It didn't happen all at once. It wasn't rolled out all at once, but it just kind of phased in at different universities. So they're able to ask before introduction of Facebook, after introduction of Facebook, what's happened to the mental health conditions of young people in this country. Okay? And this is what they find. Okay? Those are broken down into different age groups. The one that's at the very top is 18-year-olds. Okay? These are college students. And this is over the years. And before and after, there is a dramatic increase in the percentage of people who have suicidal ideations, plans, or attempts. Okay? 83% increase for college student ages related to Facebook. And the theory is, this is what the country club effect is in modern times. Okay? It's all about social comparisons. Okay? And then they looked at things like depression, anxiety, and overall mental health scores. Facebook was responsible for this increase in the mental health crisis in this country. Okay? So beware of social comparisons. Practically speaking, if you live in the same neighborhood as a cardiac surgeon and you're an internist, you're going to be unhappy. Okay? Just keep that in mind. Okay? Don't live with cardiac surgeons if you're an internist. Okay? Okay. Okay, and then Sandy has the final story.
I think the final story is, one of the biggest purchases besides your college or medical or healthcare education is going to be where you live. And so we really took into consideration this country club idea because we wanted to be with people who we felt like would keep us accountable rather than tempt us. And so one of the things that happened is this came to fruition when we decided to leave Michigan and move to Washington, D.C. for a change in job. And so it was the first time we really had to think about where we're going to live in the D.C. area. So our realtor that we got referred to was actually Burton's boss's wife. And so her name was Donna. Donna knew exactly how much money Burton was going to make for the year. So with that in mind, she came very excitedly to meet us. And we got to go and see these beautiful neighborhoods. If you know the D.C. area, there are certain neighborhoods everybody wants to live in. One of them is Chevy Chase, if you're in Maryland. And then in Virginia is McLean. So those were the zip codes that she started showing us. Beautiful, beautiful little mini mansions with those awesome countertops, you know, open kitchen, master bedrooms with ensuite bathrooms. And she was just showing us just these beautiful, beautiful neighborhoods. And then each time we would insist to her, actually, this is not the neighborhood we want to live in. We are people of faith. We really want to have not such a huge mortgage. We're interested in donating, tithing. There's a lot of priorities in our lives, so please show us other neighborhoods. She was not convinced, so we went through a week with her where she just kept showing us more and more temptations. And every afternoon, we would basically say, no, we're still not interested. So ultimately, at the end, she fired us. If you can imagine a realtor firing a commission, it's pretty inconceivable. But she basically said, I don't know what to do with you all. And if you guys were not so religious, you would have gotten just a beautiful home. And so she basically took us to a junior partner, and her junior partner is the one that finally found us a home. Why do we keep insisting on that? Is because not only did we want to have financial freedom, but we also wanted to raise a family where our kids were not inundated with voices that we felt like were going to be harmful to them as well. Because sometimes you can make good choices for your own self, but when your kid comes home and says, my classmate got the latest PlayStation 5, why don't I? You're going to, after a while, bend to that pressure. So we felt like if we can kind of insulate ourselves from the temptations, it's going to be a good investment for us in the long run. So that's our short story about the country club.
So here are the points that we just had discussed all together. So I won't necessarily repeat them all, but the big picture is money is important, and so you need to be a good financial steward of your money. And then we should seek first His kingdom, and then you will likely have enough, and that there's a lot that we can do to pay off our debts and also to give to God without sacrificing in terms of your true contentment. So for us, you know, managing money is part of everything else for a physician, which is to balance the marriage, balance medicine, balance the mission. And I think all of these areas, you and your spouse will need to be on the exact same page for. So I'd like to finish with this quote from Jesus' words. He says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, but lay up for yourself treasures on heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your heart, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So I pray that your treasure will be in the right place. And these are our emails. We encourage you to come up and talk to us if you have anything. But thank you.